first reading this morning is a poem by the American poet and spiritual writer Mark Nepo. A cancer survivor, he shares what he learned from that experience in many poems and writings. This is simply a written poem, but I don't think it will be necessarily easy for everyone to wrestle with the ideas contained herein.
Yes, it's true. I confess, I have thought great thoughts and sung great songs, all of it rehearsal for the majesty of being held. The dream is awakened when thinking I love you, and the life begins when saying I love you, and joy moves like blood when embracing others with love. My efforts now turn from trying to outrun suffering to accepting love wherever I can find it. Stripped of causes and plans and things to strive for, I have discovered everything I could need or ask for is right here in flawed abundance. We cannot eliminate hunger, but we can feed each other. We cannot eliminate loneliness, but we can hold each other. We cannot eliminate pain, but we can live a life of compassion. Ultimately, we are small living things awakened in the stream, not gods who carve out rivers. Like human fish, we are asked to experience meaning in the life that moves through the gill of our heart. There is nothing to do and nowhere to go. Accepting this, we can do everything and go anywhere.
And the second reading is a spiritual writing by Carol Prejean Zippert, who reminds us, as one commentator puts it, that the word lost always goes with the word found. It is, after all, the lost and found.
Tell me what you do when you get lost. Tell me. Tell me what you feel, how things look to you. What happens in your head? What do you say to yourself? Tell me. Can you see anything when you get lost? Can you hear what's about you? Do you perceive life at all? Tell me. Tell me what scares you most when you get lost. Can you draw from deep inside? What do you use to hold you up? Do you move yourself differently? Tell me. Tell me what you do to reach that special calm. Can you direct a prayer? When do you know to wait? When do you know to risk? Tell me. Tell me what you do when you get lost. Tell me. Then, tell me how you know when you are not lost anymore. Tell me.
Thank you.
This morning I want to do a number of things. I want to get clearer on the meanings of our theme for the month, agreement and covenant. I want to talk about limits in a free and welcoming congregation like ours. And it may seem a bit odd, I want to talk about the demolished picnic table in the little forested area near the east parking lot. It was a gift to the church from one of our coming of age classes some years ago, brightly painted and festive, but now it lies in ruins. It has been broken. It's still used, even in its present wrecked state, not by us, but as an isolated site for smoking, tobacco, and other things, for groups apparently from the neighborhood, often on their way home from school. Maybe they are responsible for the broken table, maybe they're not, I really don't know. But having introduced the issue now, I don't want to wrestle with it just yet. I just wanted to bring it up. So, as I said 2 weeks ago, our English-speaking religious ancestors were very bold. They decided to toss 1,500 years of church organization patterns and start afresh. They threw out strict hierarchy with lifelong bishops. They threw out regular synods of weighty and authoritative elders. They refused to make any use of mandatory creedal statements, no creeds whatsoever. They questioned all the hitherto required rituals like baptism by total immersion or a members-only communion service. Instead, they took fresh inspiration in some texts they found in the Hebrew scriptures, like those of the 8th century BCE prophet Amos. Can two journey together without first agreeing to do so? Can two journey together? Can they walk down the path unless they first agree to do so? A very simple, direct question. Everything else our ancestors said was secondary to that. They even expected that everything else would shift and change. Because, after all, we're all unique. They believed that beliefs would change and rituals and electoral practices and even emotional connections, they would all change. But they were convinced that what a congregation was, at its core, was a group of people committed to making community, making a congregation, despite all of the challenges and differences. They knew that when human beings come together, there would automatically be conflicts and differences of opinions. Automatically. You can't stop it from happening, since every human being is unique. So, in other words, our ancestors were eminently realistic. They realized that community doesn't happen by goodwill alone, being nice, but by steady and careful commitment to making it work. First and foremost, making it work as the supportive and transformative framework for everything else we do. The community first, and then everything else. So we agree, they said, to journey together. We agree to make community. Our ancestors called that agreement a covenant. They also called the marriage ceremony a covenant. It too consists of an agreement made between two people. But what is it that a couple agrees about? Who does the dishes? Who initiates intimacy? Who pays the bills? Who's better with money? No, none of that. The answer to those questions may change over the years. And marriage will still be marriage. Because marriage is the commitment to make the relationship work despite the inevitable changes. However, as you and I both know, sometimes marriages end. And sometimes they don't even begin. Here's what I mean. Many years ago, a couple came to me to ask me to perform their marriage ceremony. I brought them into my office and asked them some of the usual questions, including what they imagined would be different, if anything, once they call themselves a married couple. After all, they had been already living together for 2 years. So what's the difference? Good question. One of them said, "Oh, that's easy to answer. When you get married, you give up all of your other friends because your spouse is totally and entirely your focus, and you really don't need anyone else." Now, the other person turned and said, "What? Is that what you think marriage is? I renounce all my friends? I'm telling you right now, I have no intention of giving up bowling night on Thursdays. That's crazy talk." Well, things got a little tense in my office, as you might imagine. The two of them verbally duked it out right there in front of me. Clearly, they had never talked about something so basic, and they had just assumed a common understanding. Eventually, I interrupted them and I told them that I didn't see how I could marry them if they couldn't even come to a basic agreement as to what marriage was. I told them that when they had come to that basic and initial agreement as to what it meant, then they could return to my office and I would talk to them again. They never returned. Now, 2 weeks ago, I mentioned that I didn't think that a covenant had to be written down in a permanent form on a piece of paper. Our ancestors did believe that, and many congregations still do that, but it's not necessary. Like I told our children this morning, I never made a promise to them about durians, either on paper or verbally. They've never seen a durian before. Most people here have not seen a durian before. But I understood very well that it would have been unkind of me to open the fruit in a closed building. You literally all would have run from the room. So I would never do such a thing. The covenant, the agreement, not to hurt each other, not to hoodwink each other, not to be mean to each other, not to take advantage of each other, seems pretty basic to me. That's the bottom line. In Mark Nepo's words, the dream is awakened when embracing others with love. We cannot eliminate hunger once and for all, but we can feed each other. We cannot eliminate loneliness once and for all, but we can hold each other. We cannot eliminate pain, Buddha was right, but we can live a life of compassion. And so my efforts now turn from trying to outrun suffering to accepting love wherever I can find it. Now, before someone runs up here shaking their finger and saying that this passage by Mark Nepo preaches against justice activities, I invite you to hear it again. The dream is awakened. The dream is awakened. When embracing others with love, or when we are accepting love, two-way street, I like that. But what's the dream? What dream? Oh, the well-known dream summarized by Dr. King, I suppose, or even the one summarized by the prophet Isaiah 2,500 years before King was alive. I mean the dream of, quote, binding up the wounded heart, proclaiming release to all the captives and liberation to the imprisoned, to comfort those who grieve. They shall build up the ruined cities like some of our teens are going to do in June down in New Orleans on their justice trip. In short, the dream is one of justice. Get clear about that. But without reliable support in a loving community, justice work does not necessarily flow from love. It is too easily reduced to issues of righteousness, shame, and guilt. These emotions are not about justice for all people, but way too often the source of self-aggrandizement for the individual. Look what I am doing. This is a hard teaching to grasp. I know that love comes first and that justice proceeds rather immediately from love. But my whole life experience and all of my study over these last 5 decades has led me to that understanding. But when someone breaks the agreement of love, breaks the covenant of commitment, written or unspoken, I don't care, that binds us as a community, what then? Well, that's pretty tough, isn't it? So I'm thinking now of a camp I once attended at Ferry Beach in Saco, Maine. I was the chaplain there for the entire week, offering daily services in the outdoor chapel. Beautiful place. It's a Unitarian Universalist camp. A psychologist, around 50 years old, was attending the week-long conference. In the first few days, we received reports, many of them, about this man making aggressive and inappropriate sexual moves on younger people. Not teens, mind you, or children, just younger people. But he was taking initiative to touch individuals sexually. And he was not taking no for an answer. The staff got together and talked with him. He said everyone else was misreading what he was doing because they were all neurotic and he wasn't. He was sexually healthy. They weren't. That was an unsettling answer right there. We warned him that we were not interpreting their stories in that way, and he was to stop acting that way immediately or just leave. Within just an hour, somebody came and told us another story about him. He was assaulted by this man, and he came to us in tears. Well, we had tried. We had sincerely tried. We had called him back into covenant with the rest of the retreat community. We asked him to respect the verbal agreement of safety and accountability that enabled the week-long retreat to function at all. The words of that expected agreement were made clear from the beginning, even though they were not written down. But he did not respect this agreement. Clearly, he was no longer able to function in the community without hurting people at most every encounter. Whether he was a sex addict or not was not ours to analyze, nor could we have magically changed him, even if we could have proved that. The behavior was simply inconsistent, inappropriate, and endangering. So the whole staff got together, bought this man a bus ticket, and asked him to leave and go home midweek. He was very angry, but he could see that his sense of entitlement to engage in any sexual encounter he wished was simply not going to convince us. So he departed, and we were left to deal with shaken and violated people. Another psychologist present at the retreat reported the incident to the professional organization to which they both belonged. So sometimes when an agreement is broken, a covenant is shattered, the community itself, for a while, is shattered. It's sad, but again, that's a realistic understanding of life. You and I could probably offer other examples of agreements ending and covenants being broken, which are tough, but maybe not as tough as the sad event at Ferry Beach. I remember when I expressed sympathy to a young cousin of mine because his parents were getting a divorce. He said to me, "Are you kidding? Don't be sorry. Thank God they're splitting up. Those two had no idea how to live with each other. And guess who had to live on the battlefield all the ding-dong day for 17 years? Frankly, I like them much better now that they're apart. I also remember a very positive ending of a covenant. An active member of this community, this church, many years ago, loved the people here very much, but he longed for a community where there was more agreement, not just about community, but also about historically rooted words. He felt the need for ritual with deep history and for memorized devotions that had been recited for centuries. It was fine for him to know that Ralph Waldo Emerson spoke a different Unitarian language than we do, but he wanted to speak words that had been spoken a century ago and remained in continuous use. So after talking with me for months, I helped him to realize that his spiritual growth meant that he had to break covenant with us and make covenant with somebody else. And I suggested he might consider a Jewish congregation. And this is indeed what he did. He talked to the rabbi, and he became a Jew. But I kept my covenant with him as his minister to offer him encouragement toward his spiritual depth in his own terms. And he agreed peacefully to break covenant with this congregation. Still, there are times when in the midst of a covenanted community, I can feel a bit confused. Sometimes I feel pulled in so many directions that I feel dizzy. There are so many things to address in this world of ours. Immigration issues, war, there's so many of them. Poverty, sexual oppression, racism, issues of class conflict. And sometimes where there are differences of opinion within the community about what's most important, or what our goals are, or even about theology. And then I feel, well, lost. That's why I love the poem of Questions and Demands by Carol Zippert. Tell me, what do you do when you get lost? Tell me, what do you feel? What happens in your head? What do you say to yourself? Tell me, can you see anything when you get lost? Can you hear what's about you? Do you perceive life at all? Tell me. Tell me what scares you when you get lost. Can you draw from what's deep inside you? When I feel lost in a community situation, when I feel lost when a covenant is breaking, I do indeed try to figure out what I feel. But that's hard for me sometimes. My feelings are slow to name themselves. Worse, I might feel a little despondent. You know, I don't know how to respond to a situation, but I think I should know. Shouldn't 31 years of parish experience count for something? But sometimes I really just don't know. So I feel afraid. And I feel scared. When do you know when to wait? When do you know when to risk? She asks us. Good questions. But waiting is not my strong suit. And risk, well, that can be terrifying. For you as for me, right? I try to draw from deep within me, but sometimes that doesn't work as well as it sounds on paper. But you know, when I look back over my life, honestly, my life and my ministry, it does work more often than sometimes I think when I'm feeling lost. And what's inside of me? Many experiences with both success and failure, which I have reflected upon over the years. Remember what Nepo said in his poem? Like human fish, we are asked to experience meaning in the life that moves through the gill of our heart. And he also says, ultimately, we are small living things awakened in the stream, not gods who carve out the rivers in the first place. That's comforting to me, that image. What makes me scared and despondent is when I confuse myself with a God who can carve out rivers, a great being with great power. But I'm not that. I'm a small living thing in the stream of life. And that stream was here before me, and it will outlast me. And thus, memory of what came before me is also inside me. And that brings me back at last to the picnic table. You see, this vandalized picnic table is not a new thing for me. We had one in Hayward, California, also outside my former church. It was also a gift. It was also painted. And it was also vandalized. In this case, it was burnt. Our building was set back from the street like our present building is, but much, much further back on the edge of a ravine. And the picnic table provided a nice private place for smoking and drinking and partying of all sorts. But when we found the black pit burned deep into the table and beer cans littered all about and roach papers caught in the weeds and our children's play yard equipment tossed down the ravine and our wooden walls carved with initials and our metal door dented by stones thrown against it pretty hard, we were all feeling both angry and a bit lost. We were feeling very lost. We didn't know what to do. After all, we could hardly afford to post an armed guard 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And the vandals in this case had used fire. And that very flame could have easily burned down our simple wooden building if the wind had caught just right. It was much scarier than the present situation, I think. But then, lost as I was, I went deep within me. I remembered that I was a small thing in a stream, not a god. And I remembered that many years earlier, in that same stream, another small thing, a Unitarian minister and amateur scientist named Joseph Priestley, had suffered total vandalism. He lost not just his table, but his whole house and all of his laboratory equipment. The citizens of his town of Birmingham, England, got angry at his theology and his politics, and they decided to teach him a lesson. Naturally, Priestley left Birmingham. He went to London after this event. But he wrote the townsfolk a letter called "To My Late Townsmen and Neighbors," dated July 19, 1791. The letter was quite long, but I want to quote two sentences from it. "I was far from expecting the injuries which I have lately received from you, and this has been done to one who never did nor imagined you any harm." So I remembered this letter living inside of me, and I got out a piece of white cardboard and a magic marker. And I wrote the following in big letters: "To those who have carved the benches, stoned the door, set fire to the table, thrown our children's playground equipment down into San Lorenzo Creek, why? This is a small church. We struggle to get by. As the minister of this church, I do not understand why you have chosen us, who have never done you any harm, who let you sit here in peace, to hurt us and disrespect us. I just don't get it. Period." Then I taped this cardboard to the burnt table. The next day, a leader in the congregation who was visiting the church in the afternoon found the words, "We apologize," written in foot-high gravel letters on the front porch of the building. And the vandalism, believe it or not, stopped from that very day and didn't occur again for the next 3 years that I served that church. I don't know if the folks who vandalized the building were the ones who were sitting at the table every day when I'd look out from my office. I never entered into verbal or written agreement with them. They were not part of our community, nor could we even say they were from our local neighborhood. I just didn't know. But I called them to the basic unwritten agreement that makes communities, whether the community is a congregation, or a family, or a city, or even a nation, a covenant that helps all of these work for the good. As I said earlier in the sermon, the covenant, the agreement is this: not to hurt each other, not to hoodwink each other, not to be mean to each other, not to take advantage of each other. And that's just basic. When the covenant is broken in a tough way, we may feel lost, we may feel confused. But when we return to the basic idea of the covenant, the basic agreement of love, of embraces, of welcome, of wanting to journey together, which brings us together in the first place, the lost itself gets lost, and a community, a congregation, can find itself and be strong in its dream, strong in its mission, strong in both its vision and embodiment of that vision. Community is not easy, and it's not automatic. But frankly, I can't imagine refusing to agree to take up that journey. We may not, as Nepo reminded us, be able to end hunger, loneliness, and pain once and for all, and usher ourselves into the final paradise of light. But we can feed each other now, hug each other now, be compassionate toward each other now, and agree that justice is worth the dream.